Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today, her very first film was Tootsie. And since then, this woman has graced the stage, the screen, concert halls all over the world with her incredible singular talent. I'm so thrilled to welcome two-time Tony Award winner Christine Ebersole to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today is the two-time Tony Award winner, Christine Ebersole. Some of Christine's Broadway credits include War Paint, Grey Gardens, 42nd Street, Steel Magnolias on the 20th Century, Camelot, Oklahoma, Dinner at Eight, The Best Man, Blithe Spirit. Some of her film credits include Licorice Pizza, Wolf of Wall Street, Amadeus, Black Sheep, Dead Again, Richie Rich, Tootsie, True Crime, and The Big Wedding. Some of her many TV credits, including the show she currently stars on, which is Bob Hart's Abishola. She's also appeared on The Kominsky Method, American Horror Story, Blue Bloods, Madam Secretary, so many more. She performs in concert all over the world, but most recently, we are here to celebrate her latest album, which is called After the Ball, which was released through Club 44 Records. I am so honored and incredibly happy to have Christine on the podcast today. So welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, there are so many things I want to talk to you about today, but I just have to start by going backwards because Tootsie is a film, you know, everyone has their annual family get together watches, right? And so Every Thanksgiving, my entire family, my husband is one of 10 kids and he grew up in Wisconsin. And that is literally like there's turkey and there's Tootsie.
And I love it.
So you are so iconic in our home for that and so many other reasons. I have no idea if that was a great experience for you.
Oh my gosh, it was an amazing experience. Okay. Yeah, that was my first movie.
Okay, tell me everything. I'm literally going to mute my microphone and anything and everything you can remember. Did you audition for the film? What was it like on set? Were there improvisational moments going on? How long did it take to shoot the scene? Like anything and everything you can tell me.
Oh gosh. Well, I got a call. I was on the Today Show doing a performance of 80 Annie in Oklahoma. I'm not sure what it was. I'm not sure the song, but I just remember that I was performing on the Today Show, 80 Annie, Oklahoma. So I get a call from my agent saying that the producer of, you know, wants to meet me. Dustin Hoffman wants to meet me for this new movie he's doing. So they're meeting at the at this hotel on the east side, and you're going to meet him in the lobby, and you're just going to have this meeting in the lobby of this little hotel on the east side, like around 59th Street. I don't remember the name of the place. So I go there and I meet Dustin Hoffman. I was the first audition. I was the first person there. It was like 10 o'clock, whatever. So I met Dustin Hoffman and we sat and we talked and we looked through magazines, and then we kind of got up and danced. I mean, like cheek to cheek kind of dancing. And then he said to me, well, you're the first person here, but I want you to be a part of the screen test. And the screen test was for him because they wanted to see how he looked in girls' makeup, right? So the screen test, and I would just be like one of the helpers, but the main focus was on him and to see how he looked in girls' makeup. So the screen test was at a restaurant up on 73rd and like 3rd Avenue. It was a famous place, and I'm not remembering the name. So we went there and we did the screen test. We had the whole screen test the whole day. And he asked me after the screen test if I would go to the dailies with him. So I went to the dailies, and we were sitting in this darkened house, you know, to look at how he looked on film. And he was literally, it was such an amazing experience for me because he was saying, I can't do this. Who am I kidding? I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm not going to be able to do this. And here I am thinking, wait a minute. Didn't you just meet the Queen of England? Weren't you just there for, and Kramer versus Kramer, you have an Academy Award nomination right now, and you're telling me that you can't do it. And here I am, you know, at Ado Annie in Oklahoma that's saying, you've got to do this. It was so crazy, you know? It was like, what am I, like, who's doing? I mean, where am I, you know? So then after that screen test, after watching the screen test, I went with him and his parents to Wolf's, that's no longer there, but it's Wolf's Delicatessen over on 6th Avenue and like 57th Street. And we had like, you know, we were noshing, you know, and that was it. And then it was like, I got a call from my agent later that was saying, you know, you have this little part, they're offering you this little part in whatever, and I don't think you should do it. I was like, what, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? Yeah, this is my first movie. Of course I'm going to do it. You know, they're thinking, oh, it's not a big enough part. I said, I don't care what it is. So that's what the whole thing was. When I saw Dustin Hoffman after that, it had been about a year, I guess. And I had gotten the script before, the night before, of what I was supposed to do. And then Sidney Pollack came up to me the first day of rehearsal, and he's like, Dustin doesn't think that is really right for the character, for him to portray this. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to be an actress that's in the whole thing was, he says, it's improv. And the only thing that you have to hit these points of, you have to hit these points of, why are you so wired? That was the only scripted part that I was going to say. Why are you so wired? And the rest of it was up to you. So that's all made up. And that was it.
Okay.
Crazy, right? For my first movie.
Wait a minute. You start out at like 10 a.m. like at an audition at this hotel. When you say looking through magazines, I can't even, like, is that to see what looks as a woman he should go for? Like, how did it become his screen test?
Sort of like, it was just sort of like familiarizing.
Let's hang out together.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so from there, he's like, can you come to my screen test with me? And what is...
Or participate in it, you know, participate in the screen
test. Yeah. So like, what was that? Is it him pretending to be at a party scene?
No, it was basically kind of what was layer loose. I'm sure it was either the Terry Garr part or the Jessica Lange part. It was one of those two. And it was just to kind of, again, it was to see these supporting characters in this environment of him being at the restaurant or whatever as the girl.
And were you reading those lines?
No. There was no lines.
It was no lines. Improv. Just all to kind improv. Of see what it looked like.
Yeah,
it okay. Well, improv, yeah. First of all, that scene, obviously, I'm going to use the word iconic a lot because it really is. It really it really lets us know who everyone is in that world. It's such an incredible scene in terms of setting up Bill Murray and him. And, you know, the number of times, you know, we're like, Ms. Wright. Ms. Wright, and it's you. And also, you do hit your, you really do get that information with why are you so wired? And the rest of it, when he just talks about like, I haven't worked for a while, and the way you just sort of understand that and take that in and sort of, I don't know, give in to, okay, I'll hang out later and talk to you. I'll take my coat last. And of course you then leave with somebody else, which is just so perfect. All right. Well, what an incredible start, right? I mean,
it was otherworldly, really.
Yeah. And Sidney Pollack, do you have memories of him aside from just sort of, I mean, that is a lot of traffic control. That is a huge party scene with so many people. Mm-hmm. Did that take days and days to shoot?
I worked on the movie 2 days.
Okay. So most your part was handled in 2 days. Okay. I'm going to let us move on. Not happily, but I'm going to move on because your career has just been filled with so many moments like that. Like
it's so true. It's so true. It's right? just so crazy. Yeah.
Like, okay, why don't you do Camelot with Richard? I mean, okay.
And then when you come off the road from Camelot with Richard Burton and Richard Harris, then go into Saturday Night Live.
Okay. So let's with Eddie Murphy, who also ended up doing well. All right. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Illinois. I was born in a town called Park Forest, which was the first planned suburb, you know, for all the returning vets and everything. After World War II. And I lived there. I was born there. And then when I was like 5 years old, when I was 7 years old, our family moved to Winnetka, which was a suburb north of Chicago, on the North Shore, what they call. And I lived there until I was 20. I left for college. I went to McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois. And I had a professor there that said, you can't stay here. You got to go to New York. You have to go to New York.
Because you were hilarious. You could sing like an angel and act circles around everyone. And you look like a supermodel. Like, were those the reasons? Like,
I don't know. Okay. He saw something in me.
But I mean, you do have a lot of skills and you are a woman who refuses to stay in one lane. And that is why we all admire you and see you as such a fearless leader for so many of us who have decided to devote our lives to the arts. To be that funny, to actually make it onto SNL, can you tell me how you became an SNL cast member?
Well, I became an SNL cast member because Dick Ebersol, who was the producer at the time, he took over for Lorne Michaels. Well, actually Gene Demanian was there for an interim year. And then Dick Ebersol took over and he wanted to add like music to the show. And he knew that I was a singer, but it was from an audition that I did for a TV series with Tony Randall that I didn't get, ended up going to Susie Kurtz, but it was for NBC. And it was a dramatic audition where I ended up crying in the audition. So I think it was what he said was that it was believable. It was very believable. And it wasn't comedic. You know what I'm saying? And then to add the music there. So that's how I got
it. He wanted non-comedic singers to join the ensemble.
I don't know. I don't know what it was. I think I'm not sure. I must have been funny in there somewhere. I don't know, but I mean.
But you didn't have to audition. You didn't have to do stand audition. Up or characters or any of the things that we
I
sort
didn't
of.
Audition. I did not audition.
Okay. So who was on the show at the time that you joined?
Eddie Murphy, Joe Piscopo, Brian Doyle Murray, Tony Rosato, Mary Gross, Robin Duke, and myself. And Tim Kazurinsky.
Okay, so when we think of sort of Saturday Night Live, as we understand in the world of like internet and behind the scenes content, which didn't really exist when we were right. all starting out. We yeah. now kind of understand there's this writer's room and the host, yeah. you know, gets pitched ideas in terms of things that their sketches will be. And you work tirelessly writing stuff all week. And then yeah. sat right. Like, was it like that? And were you writing yeah. or just performing?
No, it was, I was, I mean, I was really, I felt, gosh, it was not my, I felt like it wasn't my wheelhouse in a sense, because right. all these people were from, you know, Second City and stand up and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, you know, I just come off the road singing, you know, "Where are the Simple Joys of Maidenhood?" You know what I mean? So it was not a familiar territory to me,
yes.
but, I was given the area that I had confidence in was my singing. And that was where I was able to express my abilities in that arena where I felt like I was at the helm in a way.
Right,
you know, I wasn't just like floating around waiting to like for the next thing to drop. That's where I could really feel like I could contribute with confidence. And so I was involved with, you know, Tom Malone, who was the, you know, the head of this SNL band. You know, we would do things like KTEL Records, like, you know, middle-aged rock and Jesus in Blue Jeans, like, things like that, or sing for, you know, the Gaddafi look, or, you know, Western Airlines, you know, so it just the jingles, you know, sing jingles.
Right.
For that.
So they yeah. wrote to your strengths. Although I also recently unearthed this hilarious sketch with you as a weather reporter on the news, uh-huh. where basically you and your, you know, the two reporters just laugh hysterically at dumb jokes for the entire
yeah.
segment, and also hilarious. Yeah. And you're not singing in it, but they yeah. understood something about how you could be really ironic, right? Like, it's a very ironic piece, but we sort of buried the lead, because very early on in your career, you are co-starring, as you just said, in Camelot with Richard Harris and Richard Burton. So how does that happen?
Well, that was amazing too, because I was doing 80 Annie on Broadway at the Pantages, and I got a call. Well, actually it was from I was in a nightclub watching someone perform on stage, and the casting director, Barry Moss, came up to me and said, "Well, what would you think about playing Guinevere opposite Richard Burton?" I was like, "Yeah, not too shabby." And he said, "Well, you know, come to the office and get the sides, you know." That was back in the old days. So I went and got the sides and auditioned on a Friday. And I had somehow given my notice in Oklahoma because I was going to take the summer off. That was okay. my idea, right? I'd yeah. already been doing it for a year. So I was going to take the summer off. And so I was 3 weeks into my 4 week notice. So I had like a week left.
Yeah.
And so I went in on a Friday, and the stage manager, Jerry Adler, was there, and I was reading with Jerry Adler the sides and everything. And all of a sudden I hear this very mellifluous voice that's coming through, you know, from the back of the house,
much you like know? your puppy right now.
My puppy, yeah. But I am now, they're inside the house. These are my puppies.
How sad that this is audio only. People, she has two of the cutest dogs I've ever seen.
Like, these are dogs.
Okay. Christine, wherever you've moved just now, you're going in and out a little bit. Can you still hear me?
All right. I know. Sorry. Okay. All right. So then.
Wait. I lost you. The last thing you said was you hear a mellifluous voice sort of coming
from the back of the house.
Okay.
And it was Richard Burton.
Mm.
So it just became like this slow motion thing, you know, where I'm like looking out through the ghost light on the stage, and I see this man in this beautiful blue cashmere V-neck sweater walking up on the stage in this slow motion, you know, and he gives me a kiss, embraces me and gives me a kiss on the cheek, and
Well, I start to read with him, and I was, you know, that the outside was, you know, very calm and like it was a normal everyday thing that I'm meeting Richard Burton for the first time. But, you know, the inside, I'm like, oh my God, that's Richard Burton. You know, it's like, these two like conflicting, you know, things were going on at the same time. And then what happened was after I read with him, then the producers came out, they said, well, kid, can you learn the part by Friday? Because what the girl that they had hired, they'd already been in weeks of rehearsal and they wanted to fire her, but they couldn't find a replacement. So that's why Barry Moss had approached me at the nightclub and all this kind of stuff, because they were already 3 weeks into rehearsal. So what ended up happening was that was on a, I believe it was a Friday or Saturday, something like that. I can't remember, but it was like, I just know that the next day I went back to work and I was taking my final bow. That was a week ahead of time. I was saying goodbye to these people that I'd been on the road with and, you know, just like had an amazing time with.
Yeah.
And then went home and packed my bags. Monday, I flew to Toronto. And Monday was the SITS probe, you know, where you sit with the orchestra and sing the songs. And thankfully, I knew them from my childhood. I knew all the songs that Julie Andrews sang because I just loved that album. And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday were tech rehearsals. And that means, you know, they're adjusting lights and all this kind of stuff on the stage. And that's when I learned the role in those 3 days from Robert Bacigalupi, who's Robert Fox, who's playing Mordred. And it was because of him that we just sat for hours and hours and hours and drilling me. And he was able to change the sound of the voice. And that's why I was able to differentiate, you know, what was happening. And Thursday night was the run through, you know, the final run through before opening night of 3,500 people. And Richard Burton came to my dressing room. He says, darling, you don't mind if I don't go on, do you? The lights are killing me. So the only time that I ever did the run through was with the understudy, Bill Perry. And so, and I never had my costumes because they were making them, they were building them. The girl who was playing the part before me was very short. And so they were building the costumes for me. So the first time I ever ran the show with Richard Burton, the first time I was ever wearing my costumes was 3 days after I got there and before an audience of 3,500 people. And the Friday morning, before opening, Franz Ahlers, who was the conductor, was, you know, you have a, like an orchestra run through, right, for the songs that you're going to do. And the first one is, you know, Where the Simple Joys of Maidenhood, right? And so I go and, you know, meet with Franz Ahlers. And, you know, he's, you know, very dignified conductor, world-renowned conductor. You know, ladies and gentlemen, this is Christine Ebersole, and she will be singing the part of Guinevere. And he's telling this to the orchestra. And so shall we begin? The first song, you know, Simple Joys of Maidenhood, you know, St. Genevieve, St. Genevieve. That's how it starts, right? So when he starts to play the orchestra, but my mind at this point had been so inundated with everything that I had to learn and perform by that night in 3 days, that when it would came to part to sing, to start the song, I could not remember St. Genevieve, St. Genevieve, it's going to be remember. I couldn't remember. So I start the first thing with da 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 da. All right, let's start again. Let's start again. So the second time he does it, and then my brow starts to get really furrowed.
This is every actor's nightmare.
Try one more time. I was like, I can't remember anything.
Can anybody help me?
Led me away and put me in this darkened room and said, don't think about anything because you're opening tonight, you know?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
How crazy is that? And then,
but it happened. You did it.
It happened. And I did it. And I think that really, honestly, the thing that I remember most about it was that when I was remember going backstage to go around backstage to make my first entrance, to get ready to make my very first entrance, I remember that the chorus singing, you know, Guinevere, Guinevere. And I was thinking, almost as if I was a child, you know, and I was transported to this magical land. And I was like, they're singing about me. And it was like this, it was this child wonderment that I didn't stand apart from it going, good God, how am I going to get through this? It was like, I was entering this magical land of musical theater. And I just like became embodied by it all somehow. It was otherworldly. There was a part during the Simple Joy. No, there was one part during the lusty month of May, I remember. And I was going to be ready to meet Lancelot and King Arthur, and they were going to come on at the same time, right? And all of a sudden, when I'm meeting them, for the first time, and there's this voice that comes, and they're talking, and there's this voice, almost as if the devil had just like sat on my shoulder and said, you have no idea what the next line is. You have no idea. And then the angel on the other shoulder is going, be here now, stay in the moment, stay in the moment. Yeah. Be here now. And it was like, you don't have no clue what you're gonna say. It was like this battle, you know, of like these supernatural forces that were battling in my brain. But somehow it was somehow like by some miracle, when it came time for me to say my line, the right line came out. I don't know how, but it just happened. So that was my experience with Glamalot.
When you think of Richard Harrison and Richard Burton, and it's funny, so many of my listeners will know exactly who we're talking about, and some of my listeners won't. And that is the reality of being a part of a world for a long time.
Yeah, sure.
It's like she was working with Harry Styles and Brad Pitt, right? Like famous these two people were. But they also have a reputation, you know, whether it's true or not, the lore is that there would be a lot of drinking backstage or even while performing. Yeah. Was that something that you had to contend with? Did you, were you aware of it? Was that?
One time when, and I'm not sure what it was, if it was like maybe medication that was maybe had gone awry or whatever it was, but there was one, incident, with Richard Burton when we were, and again, I was not sure what it was, but it happened. And we were at the State Theater in New York, and we were going to start the show. And I'm in my dressing room, and you know, I would listen to the beginning of the show, because I came on, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
And, you know, Richard Burton comes out to this thunderous applause, and he says, why is Guinevere behind those walls? I cannot reach, you know, kind of thing. So I think it's like, I wonder what the king is doing tonight. He goes into that song. But he comes out, and there's this long, extended, rapturous applause, right? And then I hear, why is Guinevere? And I was like, oh, that's not the way I
sounds different tonight.
That's different tonight. And I look up at the monitor, I was like, what's going on?
As if you can see.
I look up at the monitor, yeah. And so I just ran out to the, you know, I was all dressed and ready to go. So I ran out to, you know, the sidelines, you know, backstage.
Yeah.
And could see what was going on stage. And Susan Burton was there. And she told the stage manager to bring the curtain down. So Richard Burton had his hand, he was facing upstage.
And he turned down, imagine this, the shock of that. He turned down stage as the curtain's coming down, right? It was a very dramatic moment. And he's going, bring it up, you know? And meanwhile, it was like literally one of those like music hall fire drills moments, like when, the only thing missing was the tomatoes, you know?
Right,
the audience like turned on him like, yeah, have another drink, and they're screaming at him, you know? That was the stage. And then Jerry Adler sent out, you know, his associate to go, Mr. Burton is not feeling well. And that's like, and so, but we're going to take a break and the understudy is going to come on. And it was like a fire drill, you know, everybody left them. They stormed out because they were mad, you know? And then Bill Perry went on and was just heroic, you know, in the role. And by the end, he got a standing ovation, you know? And then Richard Burton came back the next day. So I really honestly don't know what that was.
Right.
Like I said, it happened. It was, you know, yeah. it was a medication that was, had gone awry. I don't know, but he was not himself.
Yeah.
He definitely wasn't, because I know that it was a lot of, you know, he had a lot of pain, you know, he was in a lot of pain. There was in fact, that was what he had to leave the show in California, and Richard Harris came on to take his place because he had a degenerative cervical spine. And so he could only lift the whatever the saber with the left hand. Mm-hmm. He could only ignite with the left hand. He couldn't use his right arm. And so, you know, he was in a lot of pain.
So that's where Richard Harris comes in. He came in to replace Richard Burton.
Correct. And then he went on to do it, brought it back to Broadway, to the Winter Garden, I believe. And then they went on tour, you know, all around. But I was gone by then.
Broadway debut?
My Broadway debut was in 1976. And I had just graduated from the American Academy, and I was a waitress at the Lions Rock. And through the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, I had gotten an agent, which was unusual at the time, because mm-hmm. I was doing a play called The Robsart Affair, which was about a young Queen Elizabeth I and the keeper of the horses, Robert Dudley. So that was the play that I was doing. And the agent, Lucy Kroll, was representing the playwright, Frances Letton, who was also a professor at the school. So she took to my performance and decided that she wanted to represent me. So she introduced me, I signed on with her, and then she introduced me to a producer named Shepard Traub, who originally produced a play called Angel Street back in the 40s or something, but that became the movie Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman.
Right.
Charles Boyer. So, and it actually was Angela Lansbury's first film role when she was 19 years old. So that was the part that I auditioned for, which was Nancy, the Angela Lansbury part of the Cockney maid. And so Christine Andreas was cast already in the role. But then about 6 months after I auditioned, she had gotten My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison. So she was leaving and they needed a replacement. So that's why I was waiting tables at the Lions Rock. I came home from waiting tables and Lucy Kroll called me on the phone 10 o'clock at night and said, "Darling, you're on Broadway," like that.
Wow.
And so, I didn't have my equity card, nothing. So, you know, Shepard,
they had to take care of that. Yeah.
I was waiting tables. And so I went and I did the show, and it closed after 3 weeks, and I was, you know, back waiting tables.
What a lesson, right?
Yeah,
right, it was away. Goodbye, everyone. I'm back, yes. Everyone.
That's right. 86. The Great White Way calls.
86.7. Yeah, I'm back. Winnetka, are your folks, are your family still there? Are they like, what are you doing? Are they cheering you on? Are they saying, come home? What's the...
You know, I'm long in the tooth for all of that. You know, my parents are gone, of course, but...
But
growing up, certainly in the time, my parents were actually my biggest supporters.
my dad always claimed, you know, oh, you know, I knew from the first day I laid eyes on you that you were going to be a great dramatic actress, you know.
She was correct. So you said that you were listening to Camelot in your house as a kid. So that was very helpful when you're having this out of body experience years later.
Yeah. I knew the songs.
Yes, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. Were they artistic people or just lovers of the arts?
They were lovers of the arts. You know, my mother was kind of like my first music teacher. She taught us all to sing harmony, you know, she'd play the piano and there were four children. I was the youngest of four. And she would teach us all how to sing harmony together to the Methodist hymnal, you know? And my dad was kind of probably my first acting teacher in terms of just his, you know, he had this very deep, like mellifluous voice, you know, very commanding voice, and was a very big lover of Shakespeare and all the great, you know, poets and
what was his profession?
He was an engineer. He was a CEO of a steel company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay. So it feels like other than that first Broadway show that closed after 3 weeks and then you were back to the slinging burgers, once you got going, were there many gaps or did you just keep working?
Yeah, I kept working.
It feels like that.
Yeah, it totally feels like that. It was like I went from one thing to the next. They would overlap. Yeah.
So Patty was actually on the podcast when you guys were doing War Paint together. I think she might have gotten hip replacement. Yeah. She was in a lot of physical pain.
Oh, yeah.
At that time. But that, I can only imagine, the two of you in a show together. Was that fun?
Oh yeah. I just love her. You know, she's amazing. She was always, you know, upping my game. You know what I mean? There was like, I would stand off stage when she was doing the 11 o'clock number and I would just like be, who are you? I mean, she'd be belting out these notes, you know what I mean?
And needing hip with what? With no hips.
Exactly. Like she can barely walk and she's just like, you know, it's just like, wow. She opened her mouth and was like, what? Who are you? You know?
Had you worked with her before that?
No. Uh-uh.
So did you meet on that or had you sort of
performed together? Yeah. We knew each other from just the business. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So
and mutual friends and everything.
Grey Gardens. What I mean, you know, there are 1 million lucky moments for us as your audience where we go, oh my God, this part and this woman were destined to morph into one. And you've had a lot of those. But Grey Gardens was beyond, right? Like that was just like written in the heavens and sent down to us mere mortals to watch you do it. I know Michael Greif from his very early days as a director. We met at the Berkshire Theater Festival when we were both starting out, pre-Rent, pre all the things. I mean, talk to me about the process of taking on these characters that were very niche in a pop culture sort of way, like when that movie sort of resurfaced. Right before, you know, the show was created, it kind of had this renaissance as it were.
Yeah.
So you know that people have this like indelible image of the character from the movie, and yet you're trying to create something on stage. Am I having an aneurysm? Did Michael Greif direct it?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I just had a moment. Yeah. There all the Michaels. And I was like, okay, I wanted to make sure it's not Mayer. It's Greif. Okay.
Good.
I thought so, but there are a lot of things to remember in life. Yeah. How did you guys kind of figure out how to do this for the stage and create something different since so many people could watch the movie if they wanted to?
Well, it just was, you know, very organic and just in terms of all the forces that came together. There really is no explaining it. It just,
it worked.
Yeah. When it just, you know, there was no formula. It just kind of was almost like alchemy, you know?
But did you know, I mean, were you approached with it? Did you do workshops of it? Did you?
We did workshops of it. Yeah. We did workshops of it.
So they come to you and they're like, we want you to play Little Edie and be all the Edies. How do you, did it just come to you pretty easily? Did it just fit?
Well, interestingly enough, there was something happening in the journey to that. And that was that I had gone out to Los Angeles to do a TV show that never came to fruition.
Okay.
it was called Kid Mayor. And it was, you know, I was out there out in LA for about a month. And I was staying with my friend Jeff Danis, and he said to me, you know, I had just bought a DVD player, you know, one of those portable DVD players.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to go to the video store and get some DVDs. And he said, have you ever seen Grey Gardens? I said, no, I'd heard about that, but I've never seen it. He goes, oh, rent that one. So I went in and rented a bunch of other ones, but that was the first thing I put in the DVD player, and I became obsessed. I don't know why, but it was like, I could not stop watching this. I saw it like 12 times. There was nothing else that was on that, you know, list of CDs that I had gotten that I ever watched. Right. It was all I did was watch this. And it never occurred to me, oh, you know, this will make a great musical. You know what I mean? It was like,
no, but it's such a fascinating story, and they are such fascinating women. It's incredible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just as from an actor's point of view, I guess it was just like, what made them tick, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what was just so fascinating to me. So, and so then when it came time to, you know, when I get a call from Philip Hinberg from Sundance, you know, saying, you know, can you come and do this? It was like, yeah,
you know, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's
but it
crazy.
Was like, it was like God was preparing me for it.
Yeah.
You know, before it happened, just, you know, somehow.
And was Mary Louise Wilson always in it with you? Were there different?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the two of you really created this thing together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I can't let you go without talking about your album. You just put together. So can you just talk a little bit? I mean, talk about things you can control. It's one thing most of our life we're getting a call or auditioning for things, but this is like, I imagine you generated in terms of.
Yeah. I mean, the inspiration behind that was really actually being empty nester and, you know, my husband and I being empty nesters and sort of, you know, like the kids growing up and parents growing older. That's kind of what the genesis of that was, the inspiration behind the evening that Larry Yerman and I, Larry was the musical director and conductor of Grey Gardens and War Paint.
Mm.
And so we had an opportunity to work on it when I was in Chicago doing the out of town tryouts for War Paint and was offered a spot at the Carlisle Hotel in October of 2016. So that's where it started. And then we went into the recording studio, and then it was kind of fraught. So it ended up being kind of sidelined. And then it was 5 years later that we went back and rediscovered it.
So did you record this during COVID?
No, I recorded it in 2016.
Oh, okay. I thought then it was recorded. It just took a while to get out
then,
to the world.
During the lockdown, that's when we revisited it.
Got it. And now it's in our ears and it's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Before I let you go, is there a little known fact that you can share about you?
I love licorice.
There you go. That's why you were in Licorice Pizza, another incredible, incredible role. You're just the most extraordinary human. Thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was pure joy.
So much fun.
Good. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Lots of love.
Bye.
A-OK.
One more thing. I keep getting emails asking how to donate to the podcast. First of all, thank you in advance. You are the kindest humans. Just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. That is where you donate. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. This episode of Little Known Facts was edited by Nicholas Klar. We record in New York City. The Little Known Facts theme song was written and recorded and sung by Georgia Famusa, with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you.